Hi, I'm Ken Sweeney. This is The Comfortable Spot. Welcome. Today, my guest is Benjamin Chesterton. Benjamin is a film director and producer with over 20 years' experience in visual arts. Benjamin is currently one of the people behind Duck Rabbit, which is a film production and training company that specializes in heartfelt stories in film for commercial, charity, and broadcast clients. Ben is also a strong advocate for improved human rights in visual arts and has been campaigning for stricter moral-based guidelines in photojournalism. I met Benjamin as a result of his ceaseless work in highlighting ethical abuse by professional media journalists and NGOs, and I was delighted to have time to chat with him in more detail about this continuing problem. So I hope you're sitting comfortably and happy to stay with us. Benjamin, hi, how are you? Thanks for joining me on The Comfortable Spot.
Thanks for asking me. Yeah, I'm great. I'm grand. I'm in Birmingham. Where are you?
Yeah, I'm in Dublin, and I was about to ask you how you're feeling. I know you're not on terra firma or the UK for a long, so I thought we'd get this chance in and have a chat.
Brilliant.
Great. Now, listen, you are really busy. I follow you on Twitter a lot, and I have to say, I thought I knew a fair bit about photojournalism, and then I started following you, and I opened up to this whole new world of, you know, all kinds of shenanigans going on, and we could probably talk about that later on. You have your own company, Duck Rabbit, isn't that right?
That's right, that's correct, yeah.
What exactly does Duck Rabbit do?
Principally, we're filmmakers, but we also teach storytelling, advertising agencies, and charities. It's got sort of a broad range of clients, but we focus on personal storytelling,
which is very popular now, isn't it?
I mean, the word story gets used a lot, right? This is the story of our company, etc. And it's not a story; it's like a series of events. So we try and break down what a story is, which we use for our own work. I mean, people have been doing it successfully forever, haven't they, storytelling? But just trying to get people to understand, okay, if you're going to tell a story, these are the elements that are going to fire off chemicals in other people's brains, and that makes stories memorable.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think everybody has a love for the visual media and the visual arts to some degree, whether it's just, you know, liking a poster of your favorite pop band, or right, whether it's going into the local, arts center or even a gallery and really taking time out to appreciate the intricacies of whatever's on the wall there. So it's a very broad church, isn't it?
It's huge. I mean, just as you said that, Ken, I was thinking about being a kid. And I used to buy the Melody Maker, which is a music newspaper in I don't know if it reached Ireland.
It definitely did. Yeah, anywhere that spoke English was Melody Maker land.
Okay, and NME, and they were like the rivals. And to express my identity, I used to cut out the pictures of the bands I loved and put them on the wall, so they'd be like The Cure and bands like Ride and other great stuff. So, and then you had the Athena posters. Everyone had as a student, they went away. And visual and in terms of identity, so important in how we express ourselves.
And was it something that you always had in you? Were you growing up, did you develop your love for the visual media and arts, or was that something that came to you maybe later on?
I think, I'm not sure how much of a love I do have. It's a love-hate relationship, Ken. And I guess if we're talking about photography, we'll get into that. So I do love photography. Principally, I'm interested in stories, as I said. And I think, you know, all mediums are visual. So I think, like, writing is incredibly visual and powerfully so, because you create the images in your own mind. And I think for me, that's the most powerful. Literature is the most visual medium in lots of ways, because we are... We put ourselves in a story in a way that we don't quite in the same way with film. We do, but not quite to the same way. So my first love was literature and books, particularly poetry. You have some incredible poets. Seamus Heaney was a hero of mine. He still is in lots of ways. And Yeah, so well, Yates from your end of the neck of the woods, and so that was, and I never really thought that I'd get into film, because it was expensive when I was growing up, and I didn't grow up in a way that would have sort of led to that to me, and so I ended up in radio, and again for me the spoken word is incredibly visual. You can just sort of lock yourself into a story. I've just been walking in northern France, and I started listening to a podcast called 15 Minutes from the Moon.
I listened to that as well. It's brilliant. Two seasons, yeah.
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's about the moon landings and one that went wrong and one that went right, or one that didn't actually happen. And I'm pretty good on a walk, but I kept on missing the directions. I kept on missing the signs. That was just because I was just so wrapped up. Gets on hearing a shout going, "You've gone the wrong way." That's yeah. So that's the beauty of anything that takes you away from yourself into a different world. I love that.
You give me the impression then, Ben, that you take a lot in, kind of you're like a sponge.
Trying to, I mean, yes, try and suck it all up. And for me, it's escapism, right? This idea that through words or literature or pictures, you create a different world. And I love filmmakers like Werner Herzog who do that in documentary. It's kind of like truth goes out the windows in lots of ways, but it's about how we can enter into a different world. And I had a very challenging childhood. And one of the ways that I survived my childhood was by creating other worlds. So I lived a lot of my childhood literally in other worlds that I'd created. And that was my safe place. Because the place where I was wasn't safe. So I think that sort of carried through whatever I do in life, that use of the imagination to be someone else, somewhere else, or to create stories for people like the people in my film or radio programs where you present them back to themselves the way that you see them. And so it can be an empowering thing. And most recently, I've worked with, Coco's Law in Ireland, Jackie Fenlon.
Yes.
Jackie, yeah. So I most recently made a film with her. And again, it's always about showing that amazing human being in front of you and their story, but translating it into a way that captures it, kind of in the way that they'd want to be seen and are, in the way that you see people. So again, I'm just whatever I'm doing, that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, you're doing a great job because I was looking through some of your work and I just sit there and I wonder if I had all the technology and if I had all the time, I couldn't come up with stuff like that. And it's a real credit to the hard work that you and the company Duck Rabbit do as well. I mean, some of the stuff is just superb. I wanted to ask you about the idea, the concept of an image in today's modern society, and in particular, your line of work. It's sometimes they blend or they become crossed. Say with regards, just let's talk about the photograph in one word, and its future as a media. And I'm wondering, you're really embedded in that industry, and I'm wondering, is it getting more accessible to people? Is it less exclusive? Like, when I was a child, I used to think of, say, David Bailey, for example. Oh God, I was never going to have his cameras, or if you'd see some certain movies and you'd see the art of the photography in it, and you think to yourself, this is just another world. Like a photographer was almost up there with, say, a fashion designer or a classical musician. It was an it was a, it was a te- it wasn't a technique, it was a talent combined with really hard work. And I'm wondering, the progression of this, has it made it more accessible, and in turn, has it diluted it as it being in this sort of an exclusive sort of media?
I mean, some would think it diluted it because they are. They've come off their pedestal, some photographers, or they're not, there's not a scarcity in what they do. And so they might not be able to make so much money out of it. But fundamentally, I mean, that's it. If you create an elitist system that not that many people can practice and create a scarcity, then you create value in that thing. But if there's not a meritocracy or ever, however you say that word, to get on in that medium, then that's really problematic. So what's amazing now with the revolution of the camera phone, is that kids, you know, from Ghana or Ethiopia or Sierra Leone or Bolivia, wherever you want, Mexico, they're taking the most extraordinary photographs. And they feel fresh because, or Kenya, they feel fresh because so used to people like me, the white dude with the big camera rig, going over there and showing them to the world in the way that we're brought up to see them, which is horrible in lots of ways. So it's sort of that democratization or that accessibility has unleashed, you know, a wealth of creativity and voice, which is phenomenal. So that's what excites me. And, you know, it's crazy. If you think about it, I used to live in Ethiopia. So let's take Ethiopia, for example. You know, it's being photographs there for, you know, over 100 years, probably, since the camera first traveled. And but it's always people like me, almost always, taking the photographs. So yeah, it's just amazing how fresh it is when somebody else takes the camera and says, okay, this is how I want to be seen, or this is how I want to photograph my people. So I mean, I love that. I think that's fantastic. And maybe people weren't as special as they thought they were.
That's a good way to end that one. But just wanted to keep on it for a second. Is it the same with the film, with the art of making a film? Is it easier now to make a documentary?
It is and it isn't. Because, I mean, people hate me for saying this, but yeah, taking a photograph is easy comparatively. It's certainly a more simple technical process. And filmmaking is a much, much deeper, you know, I think it's harder to make a film than a radio documentary, for example, technically. Let's just say technically, and absolutely, you know, my background was, I was at Radio 4, the BBC, I was a radio documentary producer. And I love that medium still. I think I'd still be working in that in lots of ways because of its beauty and simplicity. But then you see, you know, kids now with like YouTubers, and they're phenomenal. They reinvented.
Yeah.
They absolutely reinvented the medium of talking into a camera and completely reinvented editing. And so I just think that is that's amazing. You know, that is a revolution. And again, that was just a democratization.
And most of that probably was out of ignorance. In other words, they didn't go and watch like the original interviews, you know, Dick Kravitz or Michael, you know, Parkinson. They just went out and did it. They just put a mic in front of their best mate and talked nonsense. And eventually their nonsense became popular.
Yeah. And they watched each other.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that's it. They watched each other and sparked off each other. And you know, they were funny.
Hmm.
They're sort of creating a new language. So, yeah, I think that's magic.
Can we talk about photojournalism for a few moments? Because I'm kind of always interested in photojournalism. From very young age, I was always kind of thought that this was a section of journalism that was in some ways a little bit underappreciated, but at the same time had a very, as we talked about just earlier on there, a bit of elitist sort of thing. Mm. And I'm just wondering, looking at the way photojournalism is today, is it succeeding or failing in your opinion? Or is there still that fine balance that's happening? Because since time immemorial, when people have started taking pictures for newspapers, there's been always a, you know, history shows us that some pictures are still iconic, whether it's the guy sitting on the girder, then some pictures aren't so iconic, you know, whether it's maybe a slave and that picture was not taken to defend the slave. It was taken to, you know, just show something in a kind of a glamorous sense. So are we still at that point when it comes to photojournalism? Are they still getting it right and wrong?
So many different examples. So some people do it brilliantly, but I think fundamentally, historically, it's been quite an abusive medium and in terms of representation. So let's just take the Irish, shall we, while we're here, and we're sort of going through this event at the moment, aren't we, with the death of the Queen. And if you look at how Irish people were represented by English, you know, caricatures in Punch newspaper of Irish people as monkeys. So, you know, we've just developed with that mindset. So if we're brought up with that idea of the other as something being diminished or slightly weird or whatever that lens that we've been given, and then you put a camera in our hands, we start telling that story. We start telling other people and fundamentally misrepresenting them.
It's not a good story then.
It's not. It's really dangerous.
If we want to move on then to you with your campaign, which has really become a campaign. I don't think it started out as a campaign, but it certainly has. What you've been showing to people like me on Twitter, because I never knew that these issues existed. I always thought right. that we had a situation where organizations who are representing Western moral levels are going in and blatantly abusing that. And we want to talk about MSF, because it's what's happened with MSF is that they had quite a number of images, which they had on their website, correct me if I'm wrong, and then they were also allowing these images that were originally taken for them to go for sale. Am I missing something there?
No.
And these images were really, you know, they were exploitive images, to say the least, Ben.
Well, see, you're starting to think about it, Ken.
Yeah.
And already that anger is creeping into your voice.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously, you've expressed that quite a lot, supporting some of the things that I've been saying on Twitter. And yes, so there are thousands and thousands of images that have been taken, mostly without consent, often in medical settings, of which you'd expect a high degree of privacy. So that comes down to medical ethics. And often people in distress, very often in suffering, sometimes unconscious. But yeah, there are tens of thousands of these images and they're for sale of, you know, people suffering. It's incomprehensible that you can buy them on stock libraries and that nobody has ever said, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, you couldn't be. So there was a sense that people with cameras, particularly white people, fundamentally could access black bodies and black people who are suffering and take those images, entirely facilitated by Medicine Sans Frontières, and then sell them. So this is a form of exploitation, clearly. And I was just shocked. Just to rewind it back a little bit, a couple of years ago, I made a film for Interpol for their child sexual abuse unit. So they're the people that deal with hard drives that come in and sort through child sexual abuse material, basically. And they said to me when I was making this film, I was talking to one of the investigators, they just said it's, you know, we don't really worry so much about what's hidden. It's what's been normalized, what's already out there. And there you go. It's very clear that it become normalized, for example, to walk around and take these pictures of vulnerable people and sell them. And this has been going on for decades. But with the birth of the internet and the expanse of it, then you can commodify images much more and share them around. It's exploded. And what was extraordinary to me, so I was starting to look from my time with Interpol about the use and abuse of images and stuff that had been normalized, and this is just a classic example of something that was normalized that should never have been. And it just nobody said anything. They knew I mean, that's it. So I don't know what the defense is. There isn't any defense, and hasn't been a proper answer to how this has gone on for years and years and years, and like literally thousands and thousands of images.
It's so scary, yeah. Ben, because when I came across this, and I can remember the very first one, I can still see the image in my head.
Right.
And it was the image where the child was in this kind of rundown building beside a beach and was lying on the ground. And you were raising the issue that this was a staged photograph, if I can remember correctly.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, it started cogs going in my brain that I didn't know existed. Because it's like what you said, that we were normalized in a sense, but also we're normalized to think that this doesn't happen anymore. So we think, because we're kind of thinking about it everywhere, which is the right way to be, that they should be thinking about it. So when I come across stuff like this, I'm kind of going, I have so many conflicts in me. It's like, first of all, it's wrong. Secondly, I think it shouldn't happen, you know, to an organization that's supposed to be helping people.
Right.
And I get all these conflicts, you know, and I don't know which part to be angry more about. So I end up getting so angry and so frustrated that I literally wanted to go and bang on the door of MSF in Ireland and say, what the F are you doing? You know, and I don't know whether that's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. Because you know the way you get this battle that you've come across this battle, and I've seen you deal with it very well, much better than I would have, is that you get people saying, well, you know, it's not everybody in MSF. And that is true, because we know that there are people who have spoken out who are in MSF. But what's worse about it is they have this kind of arrogance about them where they say, oh, yes, we know we've done something wrong and we do apologize and we are working harder. You know, it's like these phrases that they have straight out of a PR book.
Nice, and it's meaningless.
I'm wondering how you feel like when you see those answers. I can see you're taking a deep breath before you reply. You know,
I mean, the apologies are just after you've heard a few of them, they're utterly meaningless, and they're just a way of nobody needs to hear sorry. They need to hear proper, significant change and contrition, like deep shame, really. I don't think, you know, we can't move on from exploiting people. That's like, so I'm sure that legally they won't admit to having exploited them, but they deep down, all of those people know that what they've done is horrific. The commodification, and that those images are all out there. They're everywhere, still for sale, including, you know, let's not get into it, but including some awful, awful scenes. So, I mean, I worked for MSF and I photographed and did a project for them in the Congo. And there's two things that really bother me, Ken. And the first is misrepresentation. So the idea that we're always going to represent you as in suffering and also helpless. So I know you grew up in working class Dublin. Am I right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. And you give, you know, an Englishman, a white Englishman, you know, a camera and go and, you know, a posh one, perhaps like me, go and photograph working class Dublin, and they'll come back with a crock of absolute rubbish, you know, of an idea of who you are and where you come from, these preconceived ideas. And, you know, once I start showing those photographs, immediately you'll say, this is rubbish, because this is my truth. This is what I grew up with. This is my history. So, yeah, if you just allow these misrepresentations to keep going and going, then it's a terrible, you know, it's a terrible injustice on those people, because we keep thinking of them in those ways as if these are truths, these images, and they're not. And then when we sort of commodify their suffering, and particularly the idea of helplessness, you know, if we just go back to the working classes, often thought of as less able, less intelligent.
The other thing about it is what I noticed when I was looking at these images is that I actually don't see the necessity of these images. I don't see why should MSF have these pictures? Because surely, you know, because it's not like the 1970s where we had this thing in Ireland called a trochra box, which was a little box, and, you know, you got it from the Catholic Church, every household had it, and, you know, you put your money in the little box, and then at the end it's full, you gave it into the church, and it had a picture of a starving, you know, African child on it. And like, you know, nowadays, like, we know that there's no need for that because people will just have an account. They'll have a direct debit. They don't even need to just, and the money's taken out and goes to whatever charity they decide to do. So when I look at these images and I say to myself, what are these images doing? You know, they're only annoying people like you and me, because what we should be seeing from MSF is the end result.
Right.
The person if this is a medical organization, like, for example, let's say you and I wanted to open a dentist shop. We're not going to show pictures of people with rotten teeth. We're going to show pictures with good teeth at the end. Right. And it's the same thing. And if these organizations are going to operate from a corporate point of view, which is really what they're doing, then they should be shown the end result. And that's what annoys me more.
It's inexplicable, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's inexplicable, but that's where there's something really, really dangerous and messed up, that you always want to see people, you know, at their worst. And the other thing is, I've traveled and I've lived and I've been I've been so many places in the world. And the one thing that I know is nobody ever asks for me to pity them.
Yes.
Only time that ever happens is with professional beggars. Okay, who might play that card, but everyone else, everywhere else, that's the last thing they want. They want to be treated with dignity, and they have inherent dignity. So if you're stripping that away, you're stripping away their dignity for your purpose, right? Because you believe that you can cash in on some idea of their suffering. And that's grotesque.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to show that MSF works, well, then show what they've done. And like, happy children, hey, this child, you know, was suffering from gonorrhea. Now they're okay. They're fine. That's what people want to see. Because everybody nowadays, you know, it's really about selling the happy story rather than a miserable story. But they seem to thrive on it. And I wanted to ask you actually something in relation to this. Are photojournalists to blame in some way or another?
Yes. So you tied the two together then. Yeah. And that's exactly right. Because if you look at what gets celebrated, so take that boy on the beach,
yeah,
just there in his pants. So it's a ridiculous photo, because if a boy lies in the sun in Africa, you know, you don't lie in the sun because you die, you burn up.
Yeah, and so we might make that mistake, but natives don't.
Exactly, that's exactly that. So the judges looking at it think, oh, that's a good photograph of climate change. There's nothing to do with climate change, because the building the boy was sleeping in is just some old building on a beach. Got absolutely nothing. But it's won an award, £10,000. And it's obviously staged, but it's been featured in The Guardian and the BBC and lots of different places. So we, you know, people like me looking at it think, oh, that's a good photo. So we've normalized again these photographs, and they love, you know, they love sort of the worst of, you know, nihilism and images of suffering. And for some reason, you know, it's voyeurism. We're looking at people's suffering, and we've turned these into good photographs, award-winning photographs, historically maybe important. I think our relationships, what the photographs are showing, is that our relationships are very broken. They're very, very deeply broken, because we're treated, the photographs tell us about the photographers. So it's not journalism, really. It tells us about the way that we look at people and want to see people, not the way they are, because the two things are completely, completely and utterly different. And that's, you know, the problem with MSFs, the deep problem with their, because it doesn't tell us anything. It doesn't tell us anything about those people. It's embarrassing how bad that they just focus on aesthetics and this aestheticalization of suffering predominantly. That's why we see a lot of children, you know, and women don't see so much, you know, of the men unless they're in war. So I think photojournalism it's got very little to do with journalism, and it's got a history that will be reckoned with, because when, as we've just seen with the Queen dying, and suddenly, you know, there's a confrontation of English people, the Queen is our symbol, and then there's, okay, but well, what have we had to cover up to be able to maintain this, you know, this idea of monarchy in the UK? And I'm somebody who's worked for a charity for the Queen, right? And and slowly, we're coming to a realization of historically the things that predominantly white people did in colonial relationships with black people and countries. And photojournalism is just an extension of that.
And it's the other thing about it is photojournalism was the kind of the bridge between, you know, the guys back home and the guys in the colonial areas, because they would see the photographs, and the photographs would be, as you know, they'd always be these staged pictures where they'd have natives dressed up as butlers and all this kind of crazy stuff. And like up, as you say, up till only 10 or 15 years ago, people still took that as the norm. And it's absolutely crazy. Can journalists do anything nowadays, you know, to stop what is happening, say, with the example of MSF? And as well, can they do it in order to highlight social issues without exploiting the subject? Because then we're talking about the subject here are people.
Yeah. I think that's... I don't think it's that hard. I mean, you know, it's not that hard to sit, to be with someone, to be alongside someone. I think... The danger is that, you know, there'd be a lot of backlash, and then it might be, well, are, for example, black people, are they safe in these countries to be photographed by white people if we keep exploiting them? And that then becomes a real serious issue of, well, you know, are they doing harm, and will they continue to do harm, and will they, you know, white people be excluded from continuing to shoot in these places and arguably exploiting?
You know, I've known a lot of journalists, and many of, you know, would have got a degree in journalism, for example. And, you know, the core issue going through their education as journalists is to, you know, make sure that they tell the truth in order to not exploit the situation. So our photojournalists, they're not taking this path. It seems to me some of them aren't. And they seem to be in a kind of a little, it's almost like as if they're artists themselves.
Exactly.
And they're using you know, these people as their subjects just to, you know, bring out a certain color range or a certain style or a certain feeling. And they still seem to want to be about themselves. And I always say to that, well, go off and photograph your family. You know, don't be taking pictures of people without permission or half naked or in a compromising situation. So, is it time now that people should start calling out these people and saying, you're not a photojournalist?
I mean, you know, you're not a decent human being when you're treating, when you're punching down, you know, fundamentally for your own success. I mean, it's just, we know better than that. We don't even need to, you know, hugely debate it, do we? We know, do unto others as you'd have done unto yourself. It's important to document these things, but how you document them has to take into account the experience and the life of the person who's being documented, rather than it being something that's done to them. So, I mean, we can make a distinction between a news photograph that happens in front of you and someone pulls out their camera and takes it. And it's important that you can do that, because otherwise things get covered up. Right. So that's, you know, it's a very important freedom.
Would a good example of that, Ben, be the children coming across the bridge after the napalm attack in Vietnam, that very famous black and white photograph?
That's a very fascinating. That's a great example, because the girl was really angry about that photograph for many, many years. And very few children like it when there's pictures of themselves naked, for example, that then get shared. And as they grow up, that, you know, and obviously this was a traumatic event, so there's like a layer of different layers of trauma in involved. And then that photograph becoming famous was awful for her as a young woman. And later she became at peace with the photograph, and she started her own peace foundation and has used it. So she's happy at that point. But she was able to move to Canada and start a new life. And most children aren't able to do that, you know, from the Vietnam. So very specific circumstances at play. It probably wouldn't be published now. If it was shot now by a photographer, it's very unlikely a newspaper would publish a similar, that certainly probably remove the identification of of the child. And you, and remember that photographs were put in newspapers, and that's where they were always seen in context. And now the internet has allowed us to take them out of context, you know, and meme them and all things like that. And that makes them more dangerous if you're the person in the photograph and you're upset with that image. And obviously, you know, that can be whether it's like people taking photographs that they shouldn't do, sexual images, and then sharing them of their intimate partners. And so the camera can be a weapon, and it can be a weapon pointing different ways. And I think the issue is it's punching down on these people rather than respecting them. So that was a news photograph. It wasn't set up. It wasn't staged. Now, when that child, she was taken burning, and the photographer picked her up, and he carried her, he saved her life, he took her to hospital. When she arrived at hospital, he didn't take his camera out and photograph her being treated.
There you go. Can we mention that guy's name? Do you happen to know who the photographer was?
So it's Nick Utt.
Right.
And Kim Fuck was the child. So yeah, so he didn't, you know, photograph her. So there's a difference between private spaces and public spaces, and then we can judge of whether it's newsworthy or not.
See, the problem I find with that picture is that it was taken a long time ago now, right? And as you said, it was taken in the heat of the moment, excuse the horrible pun there. But the problem with that is, it because it became so popular, it became a benchmark, I think, incorrectly. And people started to say, oh, yeah, well, I remember that picture back in 1960 when they took that photograph. So they took that then, they can take one. I can take one now of this kid in Sierra Leone. You know, and I think this is the problem. I think that you'll find that some people are using it as an excuse, but they're going way over the line of that journalism.
Yeah, and also there was a lot of myths made around this photograph that ended the war. When the president, there's an audio recording of the president with one of his advisors, and he asks, I think he says something like, did we do that? Was that us?
Right.
Is the image a propaganda image? Right. So that's another layer on there, which is telling us that images like this, it was reasonable to the American president that it was created by them as a propaganda image. And so that tells us a lot about how we should be looking at images, and whether we and who is creating them, for whom, by whom, and whether what questions we should be asking. Is this been set up? Who is this serving? And is this bringing us into the life of these people, or is this some kind of staged spectacle? And it wasn't in this case, but certainly lots of images historically have been. So we need to look at them critically, and you know, the motivations behind taking them. And we've got to be careful not to afford too much power to them. So that image, they said, it stopped the war. It didn't at all in any sort of meaningful way. It did hit the newspapers, and it's become, you know, culturally iconic, but it wasn't, the war was ending anyway, but it went on for several years after that anyway.
When you look at the images online, and the ones that you're highlighting, I'm trying to find more, but I'm nowhere as good as you being able to see these. But what I like about what you do when you see these images online is that you turn it on the photographer. You know, you immediately take the emphasis away from the person in the photograph. You know, you blank their image out. You'd never mention their names. And then, like, within the first tweet, when you're highlighting these sort of images, you immediately go to the photographer. And I like that, because I think what you're doing there is you're putting the spotlight on them and saying, why did you take this picture?
Well, that's it. I'm asking, what are you doing? Sometimes when I give talks, I relate it to my own childhood. So I was abused as a child, not sexually, but my parents believed I was demonic. And from a very, very young age, I mean, it was completely whack. And they had me exercised and all kinds of, and I was beaten a lot physically. Wow. In a quite a sadistic, horrible way. And, you know, which involved nudity and all sorts of things. But anyway, I'm an adult and I've processed those things that happened to me, although they changed me through going to therapy. And I can sit here and tell you these things, and I'm in control of that. And I've decided, you know, what I want to say and what I don't want to say. And I can share my experiences and connect with other people, you know, who might have had similar sort of experiences, and explain why it's wrong and how it damaged me as a human being. Now, if you stick a photographer in the room photographing while that happens to me, that idea I find more sickening than actually the thing that I've dealt with, which did happen to me. And so this idea that you've got to be in the room, you've got to show it, is really, really sick. Because let's take another example, female genital mutilation. The idea that you need to show a child as they're going through the worst experience for us to care is ridiculous and absurd. And again, it's another form, it's a layer of abuse on the abuse. You're now, as a photographer, in my opinion, you're now an abuser at that point, because you're complicit. And not in all cases, but in lots of cases. And then you add, now I've photographed you while you're undergoing female genital mutilation, and now I'm going to commodify that. So, and this can only happen, the commodification, if those photographs had been taken of me, I'd have them stopped and taken away, and I'd sue, for example. But that with it, if we go back to the MSF, the kids and the adults and the women in those photographs, they can't. They probably don't even know they're being sold.
Yeah.
Names weren't even taken properly, probably. So it's enabled to happen because they have no power. Now, I have a little bit of power, and, you know, just as someone who speaks up. And I think it's important to raise your voice and say, why are you doing this? Some people say arguments are like, oh, I think it's iconoclast is the word.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I mean, it's, you know, it's fundamentally ridiculous. The MSF said, for example, one of the things they said, there's a tension between journalism and medical ethics. And there is no, because I don't know what happened in Ireland, but we had COVID in the UK. He really didn't do a good job. A lot of people died, but there was no photographer who entered hospitals taking photographs without consent.
Same here.
It didn't happen. And there was no argument that they would or should. There's no debate around that. We just think that would be crazy. And of course, if somebody wants to have a photograph taken, you know, as they're suffering, then they can do. There's nothing, you sure. know, to stop that.
And if you did, of course, I would have seen them
did.
On Twitter.
Yes.
People warning them, saying, stories. "Look, I didn't get the vaccine, and look what's happened to me." You
yes.
know, a lot of people took those pictures, and
absolutely.
Very brave of them to do that as well.
So absolutely. So I've never argued against, you know, people telling their stories, because that's what I do fundamentally. But when you take away their right, when you remove it, and you're taking by taking the image without consent, without understanding, and particularly you're just looking for suffering, particularly, and then we're saying these are good photographs and these are award-winning. And fundamentally, that weird thing that you're not seeing at MSF the people coming out who are healed. And there's amazing people working at MSF, and they do amazing work. Fundamentally, something is really corrupt.
It seems to be corrupt, and it seems to be corrupt all the way through, doesn't it? Because if, as you said there, some of these pictures are award-winning pictures, so that means then it's like getting that extra layer of super legitimization.
Absolutely.
It's like winning an Academy Award, you know, like when your movie, like we all know some bad films have won the Academy
yeah.
Awards, but whatever the outcome, whatever your opinion on the movies, you get to know what those movies are. And I'm sure it's the same in photojournalism. So they get this extra layer, and it really gives them this almost sense of invincibility when they're going on their next shoot.
Absolutely correct. And that's it. And what someone like an organization, MSF, has said, go out and do this. It's good. Shoot. For example, fully identified children who are HIV positive.
Crazy.
I mean, that's wild. Or, you know, that is absolutely wild. Or waiting room.
What's wilder is actually, Ben, sorry for jumping on you there. You
yeah.
just nailed one there. is that it's not only stigmatizing the person where they come from, it's stigmatizing them here as well, because there's so much prejudice still, even 40 years on after, you know, HIV was first discovered. People still out there believe that, oh, it's a gay disease, or, you know, you can get it if you drink from a cup or if you shake somebody's hand. So when you see these photographs, they really do. They add this. Again, we're adding an extra layer here, aren't we?
Yeah, and then, you know, and that's it. So the tension is not between medical ethics and journalism, because there isn't a tension there. The tension is between medical ethics and the exploitation of patients.
Yeah.
That's it, because the medical ethics would not allow this to happen. They couldn't. They can't. And the exploitation of patients for financial gain. And that is exactly what we've seen. And they've done it because they can, right? And so that's what needs to be heavily, heavily addressed. But they've done it because they can, and people said it was good.
And the other thing as well, Ben, is they've broken the Hippocratic Oath, because absolutely, they said they do no harm. And this do no harm, it's not a physical harm. You know, it's a psychological harm.
Of course.
So they've done it, and they don't even see the fact. Well, they have probably seen the fact that they've done it, but they decide to choose that they're not going to recognize that as part of the Hippocratic Oath.
It's the idea that this person has less rights than me. They're less human, because otherwise, you know, in my letter to MSF, it was, are you running an organization where you work in UK hospitals with one set of expectations of your patients, and then they go out the window? Obviously, medical ethics does vary from country to country,
sure,
but you know, fundamentally, it's not even a medical ethics, it's a human right to dignity and privacy. So, and not to have your health status, you know, particularly photographs, for example, of people as survivors of sexual assault and things like that. You just, you know, to take a photograph of them as a child and then be selling it as stock. This is, so I don't think it's that complicated. I think some people want to make it complicated. I think we, you know, we generally know when we watch something, and like a film, or and the person in it, in the documentary, is empowered to have an element of control. And those stories are deep, and they have layers to them. They're not about positive or negative. They're about going on journeys with people, and all of our lives, all of our journeys are a mixture of joy and suffering and pain and hope and back round again, and sometimes despair, hopefully not. So I think we can, you know, it's quite easy to recognize people are working ethically and with care and concern. You can still make mistakes, and it's quite easy, very easy to recognize the exploiters. Very, very easy. As I say, I worked for MSF in Congo. It never occurred to me for one second, my company did, that we would sell the photographs as stock. It never, I mean, the idea was just, that's inexplicable. I can't. And there's a difference there, just to finish, there's a difference there between a radio person and a so-called photojournalist. Because when we tell people stories in radio, we create a story, and we would never imagine those voices really being taken out of context and sold to promote something else. I mean, that's just, I don't know anybody in radio who would even comprehend that's happening. So, but the business model of photojournalism encourages it.
Definitely. And the other thing I'd say is that, I mean, I know that when I repost or retweet some of your work or some of your campaigning, I know it makes some people I know personally uncomfortable, because they're journalists, but I don't care. I've actually said it. I said, I'd put their names in the tweets. I said, get up off your backside and do something about this. You know, you're writing for a newspaper, or you're working for a TV station.
Right.
You know, so I don't care. It's actually one of the very few times where I've actually felt I really have a role to play here. And it's only a small role, but if we all get together with our small roles and play this role, well, then it becomes a big role. You have to keep highlighting it, you know. And I really applaud you for doing it. It's amazing, and I'm right there beside you all the time. I'm not as articulate as you are, but I can certainly retweet your very articulate work, and I fair play to you, it's really, really brilliant, Ben.
You know, it's just getting it. You're totally right. It's just getting it in front of more and more people, because it's a dirty secret. Newspapers don't really. The Guardian did a piece, and fair play to them, but they were very uncomfortable with the stock angle. And the reason is because they use a lot of stock.
They do, yeah.
So, and they sell a lot, and they all do. So so for the newspapers, this is not a comfortable space to be in at all. And obviously, the history of photojournalism is working through newspapers and magazines. So that accounts for the reticence. So I was very pleased the Guardian did. I had to push them a little bit on that stock angle. They were not, you know, that keen on it. But I was very pleased that they did. But fundamentally, I think anybody looking at this coldly, or not even coldly, it's an automatically, oh my God, how is this happening? How is this? That's where I'm going to keep going for a little while. I'm writing it all up with all the examples, and then I'll probably ask people to sign something to try and get a independent review into the use and abuse of images at MSF, because they really can't look at themselves. I mean, this is so culturally embedded into their organization, this, that the idea that they're going to address the problem significantly internally is an absolute nonsense. And above and beyond that, what I would love, Ken, is what matters to me is, you know, I believe that all, I'm particularly interested in children because of my own childhood, but that we should be treated equally. So the rights of my children should not have more rights than the rights of my Ethiopian friend's children, or anybody's children, friend or not.
Absolutely.
And fundamentally, that has to change, that we particularly people like me, white people like me, don't go into spaces and treat people, particularly black people, but not exclusively, as props, or because we always arrive loaded with, you know, went back to the, you know, the misrepresentations of Irish people and the horrific history in our country of how they were treated when they came to live in England, particularly in Britain. And so we have to, you know, we've got to unpack some of these things and relearn how to treat other people. And unfortunately, the photographs have set a lot of that back.
No, they have. But I mean, it's brilliant that what you're doing. Keep up the good work. And, you know, as I said, I'll be there to make sure that people on my side of the field here get to know it. Can I ask you a little bit about Duck Rabbit? Tell me a little bit, what in the work do you do there?
Oh, well, it's a kind of Duck Rabbit. Well, I was at the BBC for a long time, and then I went to live in Ethiopia. And that's when I really changed my way of thinking, because I went to Ethiopia with such stereotypes based on predominantly on the images, right, that I'd seen. And I remember when I moved to Ethiopia, I was staying in the Hilton Hotel before I got my first house, and I was running a project on sexual reproductive health for young people and journalism training. And, you know, I was like, is it safe to leave the hotel? Right. Okay. Addis Ababa is brilliant. It's an amazing city and totally safe there. You know, I just landed with so many wrong ideas, and that's embarrassing, but it's true. So it needs to be owned up to. So, and that's how I, you know, started to think about these things and the way that I'd been conditioned to look at the world and how ridiculous it was, and how it affected the way that I worked. So Duck Rabbit is an image that can be seen two ways. Some people see a duck, some people see a rabbit. It was first talked about by the Austrian philosopher Wittgenstein, image around about 1900 by a guy called Jastrow. And it's just the way that we see the world. We think, we look at it one way, and until somebody points out, well, actually, there's a duck and you're seeing a rabbit, you'll never see the duck. And it's about that exchange of, and how stories can open us up to different ways of thinking and feeling, and that it's a powerful medium. So that's really what we're working in it, but it's kind of a lifestyle choice as well. I got that, you know, after how many years of the BBC, I started to get the dreaded sinking feeling going in to work. The idea that at some point I'd be sort of redundant what I was doing. fundamentally, and I didn't know what else to do in my life. So Duck Rabbit came about, and we first started working with the still image and audio. So called them photo films, but they're audio slideshows. But over time, we couldn't make enough money doing that. That's the honest truth. But I love documentary, yeah. Love audio and the still. So to put the two together, and that was a wonderful way to learn about filmmaking. And that's how we became filmmakers.
So we can get you at duckrabbit.info. Nice.
That's correct.
Yeah. I like that.
Follow me on Twitter @duckrabbitblog. Yeah. @duckrabbitblog. I think, you know, I sort of I work for hire, and then the sort of activism is just pure passion and with anger.
No, it's very controlled. I've seen real anger, and that's you've got a nice style about you. It makes people think and look and watch. I always ask my guests, what are you reading, watching, or listening to at the moment? Because we've so much, you know, available to us nowadays.
So I'm rereading a book at the moment. It's by a guy called Daniel Kahneman.
Mm-hmm.
He's an economist, a winner of the Nobel Prize. Not necessarily a good thing, is it? But it's called a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. I mean, it's really about how the brain works and how useless our minds are. In a sense, they're amazing things, but we just come to snap judgments all the time.
Yeah.
And it's really about analyzing why, when we see that picture of the boy lying in the sun, and we think that's a good photograph, and because we haven't given it enough thought. And basically, we're just geared as human beings not to give things enough thought, and the need to slow down and to really think about things. So his work is absolutely amazing. And the book that I always recommend everyone should read is Where the Wild Things Are by Morris Sendak.
Yeah, it's not watch the movie.
The movie's all
okay.
Right,
yeah, but the film.
I don't hate it. Yeah. The book is like my favorite book. And I always use it in training, and it's just so beautifully written. And I've got it in front of me right now, and it's just something that even when I hold it gives me joy.
Great. I mean, that's brilliant. I have a few books like that as well. You go back to it, don't you? And sometimes you just pull sections out and just read a chapter, even though, you know, it can't be in the middle of the book.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and then books have feelings because you had, you know, when you were a child and then you're a parent and having read to your own children. So I love that.
Yeah, it's great. And do you get a chance to watch TV at all? I know you do a lot of filming, so I'm wondering about that.
I do. What made me cry a lot, and like gasp for air, and absolutely was like just blew my mm-hmm. mind in the last couple of years, is okay. Normal People.
No.
Yeah.
Really? Is. Okay. Yes. Fantastic.
Yeah, it broke me. I was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was like I know that a lot of people felt the same.
Yeah. Yeah. It shut Ireland down. You know, when it was on the TV, Ireland shut down.
Really?
Except for the kind of rosary bead clutchers who thought it was a disgrace.
Right. Okay, well, it was I think lots of us are carrying these sort of little wounds.
Yeah.
From our teenage years, from love unrequited, or mm-hmm. you know, and I reckon I must have been, because at times I was like gasping for air, and what I loved about it is I loved the short episodes so much. Like TV now is just longer and longer and longer and longer, and it's like the latest series of Stranger Things. Like it was all right, but it just went on and on, and some of the episodes went on and on forever. And I love that Normal People. And I make short films, right? So that's my area. Mm-hmm. But I just loved that it was this short, sharp, 20, 25-minute hit, and absolutely beautifully acted. And as I say, gasping for air at times watching that. And I know a lot of people felt the same. I also watched It's a Sin recently that I hadn't seen. Mm-hmm. And that was about... HIV, particularly in the gay community, when it first came to London, and again, we really sobbed a lot.
Wow.
It's a TV series that should be shown in schools,
Not perfect, but it was very, very touching, and we sobbed a lot during that.
Well, fair play. See, I don't think I would have been able to say that I cried, although I cannot remember any time I've ever cried on a TV or film, so I'm waiting for that duck to be broken.
I'm a softie, I reckon.
You know, I'm a bit of a softie too, but I think I'm more, I think as I'm getting older, I'm just more cynical, you know. So yeah. I kind of go, it's not real, you know yourself.
Yeah.
Although what it do get me, what does get me sometimes is when I watch some documentaries, they really, you know, they can touch me sometimes.
Right.
You know, especially like, I mean, even something as kind of trivial as Who Do You Think You Are, you know, right. You kind of go, that's an amazing scene, or, you know, God, I remember that, you know. So, yeah, no, I think we're all softies at heart. And I think this is the thing. We probably should show it a little bit more, Ben.
Yeah.
Ben, thanks so much for joining me today on The Comfortable Spot. It's been brilliant having you. I think we could have talked for an hour. We probably should maybe meet up at some point for a beer somewhere in Europe.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sorry I was a bit incoherent, tired. And
that's okay.
Thank you so much for asking me. It's really... it's really nice.
No, it's great. And hopefully we can get, as I said, people to find out a little bit more what we're talking about and maybe dig a little bit deeper and not let things happen so naturally when they see something. Guys, you've been listening to The Comfortable Spot. My name is Ken Sweeney. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we will see you real soon. So take care, y'all. Bye-bye. ¶¶